Russia and China accused the United States of trying to destroy international legal architecture and trying to rely on Cold War-era military and political alliances. Israelis vote in their fourth election in less than 2 years, with voters still divided over whether Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu deserves to remain in office. Also coming up, Germany reverses plans to reopen the economy and will enter a strict 5-day shutdown in a bid to break the third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. Thanks for joining us. China and Russia view the U.S. as trying to destroy international legal architecture. That's according to a joint statement by the Russian and Chinese top diplomats. The statement accused the U.S. of relying on Cold War-era military and political alliances. It also blasted European and Western sanctions as unacceptable. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is in China, where he met with the Chinese counterpart Wang Yi on Monday and Tuesday. During their talks, to urge the U.S. to halt unilateral bullying and stop meddling in other countries' domestic affairs. The U.S. has imposed sanctions on both China and Russia in the past months over various issues. The measures have escalated U.S. tensions with the two countries. Israelis are heading to the polls to cast ballots in the fourth general election in less than 2 years. The latest opinion polls have suggested a continued political deadlock there. None of the Israeli blocs seem likely to secure the required 61 seats for forming a cabinet. The election comes as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is on trial for corruption and faces criticism over his COVID response. Netanyahu has two main opponents. One is Gideon Saar, the leader of Israel's New Hope Party. Another rival is Naftali Bennett, the chairman of the far-right Yamina Party. Netanyahu has remained in power since the first inconclusive elections in 2019, based on an emergency agreement. Mona Kandil on the West Bank says whoever becomes the next Israeli prime minister would continue the regime's aggressive policies against Palestinians.
There are several scenarios. The first scenario they are speaking about, that there are four parties. There's the Likud, Shas, United Torah and Judaism, religious Zionism. Those have commitments to support the Netanyahu-led regime. However, as you were speaking, there is Naftali Bennett's Yamina. He's calling for a change, and here experts are saying that Netanyahu has lost some of his supporters, like Naftali Bennett, and there is Gideon Saar as well calling for a change. So Netanyahu's chances are the same like the three previous elections. But experts are saying there might be a change because the Israelis are fed up from the election. Whoever will be the Israeli prime minister and whatever would be the form of the next Israeli regime or the Israeli cabinet, nothing will change on ground because the Israeli officials compete in order to show who's more aggressive to the Palestinians and who will be allowing the settlers to confiscate more lands and build Israeli settlements.
Germany says it will impose a strict 5-day shutdown over the Easter holidays next week to contain a third wave of coronavirus.
We are at a place where we are now in a very, very serious situation. The 1st and 3rd of April will be designated one of quiet days with extensive contact restrictions as well as a ban on gatherings between 1st and 5th of April, an extended quiet time over Easter. The point is that over 5 consecutive days, people should stay at home.
Germany is also extending its general lockdown until April 18, reversing a plan to gradually reopen the economy. Authorities say that COVID cases are rising exponentially and intensive care beds are filling up again. In the past 24 hours, the country has reported nearly 7,500 new COVID cases and 250 related deaths. Elsewhere in Europe, Ukraine registered more than 330 new deaths in the past 24 hours. That was a record daily high. New cases were above 11,400 there. More than half of all UK adults have had their first COVID vaccination, with plans in place to immunize the entire population by the end of summer. Efforts are now underway to open large public events with COVID passports as a possible solution, but as Murtaza Jaffa reports, there is a growing backlash against such proposals.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
I'm going to go back to our story regarding Russia and China. Huynh Du Zhu is a senior fellow at the Pan Gol Institution who joins us. Welcome. You know, when you take a look at how Russia and China have further committed to their allegiance, it's interesting what the Russian foreign minister said prior to going to China regarding the dollar. And he said that Moscow and Beijing should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their own economies against the Western sanctions. I'm assuming that means to trade in their national currencies. And he accused the West overall of trying to maintain this domination over the global economy. And of course, the use of sanctions is part of that. Do you think that the union of Russia and China to lead the way towards trying to decrease the role of the dollar is something that's feasible?
Few countries would oppose the dominance of U.S. dollars, dominance of U.S. economy in the global community. But we have seen over the past years in particular, the frequent use of this unilateral coercive measures against other countries, in particular, for example, Iran, Russia, now China, and many other countries. So you can see the U.S. is trying to achieve its purpose without resorting to war, much costly means, probably. So you are using, they are using their financial dominance basically to serve their national interests. And facing such a situation, other countries naturally will find a way to avoid the use of dollar or reduce the reliance on the U.S. dollar. But now we are seeing, obviously, Russia has been leading the effort, and they are doing it pretty well, let's say. We know that Russia has been suffering from sanctions from not only the U.S., but in general the Western nations. But the Russia's economy has been resilient over the past almost a decade. And also, you can, as a case in point, you know, trade between China and Russia back like eight years ago, the use of bilateral currencies, you know, the Russian and Chinese currencies, was about 2 or 3% of their total trade. And the last year, it's 25% of the total volume of trade were used, that were traded, actually settled between the Chinese yuan and the U.S. and the Russia ruble instead of U.S. dollars. So yes, as long as you try hard, you can find a way to reduce your dependence, your reliance on the use of U.S. dollars. And in addition to that, you know, we know China is developing rapidly about, you know, its economy, the second largest, it's, you know, quite dominant, at least in this region. And if you take a look at the trading of goods, China is the largest country of trade of goods. And also China is developing quickly about the digital yuan, a digital currency. So hopefully that will help promote the use of bilateral currencies, for example, Iran with China, Iran with Russia, or Iran with other countries. Instead of relying on the dollar, U.S. dollar, you can use your own currency. So to reduce the rule of U.S. dollar as a means against this unilateral coercive measures by Washington.
Okay, and finally, quickly, if you don't mind, since we're short of time, you mentioned a very key point there as to whether other countries, including countries of the EU, are going to hop on board with the U.S. It seems like for now they may be doing that. But is it going to come at their own expense? Because when you take a look at, for example, China, it was estimated that by the year 2028, it's going to overtake the U.S. economy. Some say that that has happened already. China has grown out of the COVID-19, I think around 4 or 6% growth. Yet the U.S. has to pump, what, about $2 trillion into its economy, and it's just basic cash being handed out to its citizens, not knowing whether that's going to actually stimulate its economy or not. Don't you think that this approach that the U.S. has towards Russia, towards China, may backfire, and it may other countries may say, listen, China's on the rise, as you mentioned, Asia is on the rise, and yet the U.S. Is kind of on the back foot?
Yes, I think, you know, for the U.S., you know, the underlying factor in the fight against China, against Russia, in particular against China, I think there is a worry or anxiety, you know, somehow the success of China represents a big challenge to the U.S. system. We know the Washington consensus, you know, Washington would say, you know, you follow my example, follow my political system, follow my market system, then you'll become prosperous, you become stable, etc. But now China provides a different model, and still you can achieve all those goals of being stable, being prosperous, and being peaceful. So they say that they see that as a challenge, even as a threat. You know, it's really up to Washington to make changes to accommodate a different style, a different model. You know, countries are different with different cultures. They should be allowed to grow based on their own national conditions.
Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Gwen Dazhu, senior fellow at Pangol Institution from Beijing. Many thanks for your thoughts. 10 people, including a police officer, have been killed in a shooting incident at a supermarket in the U.S. city of Boulder, Colorado. Local police forces, as well as FBI officers, were dispatched to the scene to respond to, quote, an armed and dangerous individual. The injured suspect has been taken into custody. The police say the threat has been eliminated. There is no immediate information on the shooter's identity or motive, but an investigation has been launched into the incident. The U.S. loses around 33,000 people to gun violence every year. Additionally, more than 100,000 people are shot each year in the country. Former member of U.S. Marshals Service Matthew Fox says easy access to firearms is the main culprit for shooting incidents in the country.
Well, I mean, it's just like all the rest of them. We've had quite a few in the United States over the last few years. The bottom line is, there are a lot of guns on the streets in the United States. People have access to guns. You know, the concern is a lot of people are anxieties out there. A lot of people are taking out their feelings on going out there, trying to do whatever it is, vigilante style. In this particular case, they're doing an investigation, so they don't really know. They're saying they don't really know the motive yet. But I mean, in the close proximity of the Asian killing, I don't know if this here had anything to do with race, but the bottom line is you got so many people dead, and you got a person that just went in and started shooting. And in the United States, we have so many open facilities where people can just come in with a gun and start firing. That can happen, and we've been seeing it over and over again.
Moving on, North Korea has called on China to strengthen unity and cooperation between the two countries. In a verbal message to Beijing, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un praised his country's close ties with China and expressed hope to boost them further. He also called for intensifying the strategic communication between the two sides. Earlier on Monday, in a similar message, the Chinese President Xi Jinping said that his country is willing to work with Pyongyang to preserve peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. The calls are seen as a clear message to Washington, as both have accused U.S. President Joe Biden of following in the footsteps of his predecessor, Donald Trump. Jennifer Chang says U.S. President Joe Biden is continuing with his predecessor's maximum pressure and sanctions strategy on North Korea.
And the Biden administration is continuing the Trump administration's hardline policy of inflicting maximum sanctions and pressure on Pyongyang so far. So now North Korea is just waiting to see if the Biden administration is going to continue this kind of a hard line. Now, with China, already the Biden administration Secretary of State, Blinken, has already had a verbal argument in public with the Chinese foreign minister in Alaska. And this also is exacerbating the whole situation with North Korea, because China is North Korea's main ally. And right now they are talking to each other about how they are going to defend themselves against the aggressive U.S. strategy.
Massive fire has swept through a Rohingya refugee camp in southern Bangladesh, forcing tens of thousands to flee. Bangladeshi officials say the blaze has displaced at least 50,000 refugees. They say that seven people are also feared dead. The blaze broke out in Cox's Bazar on Monday. It is the largest in multiple fires that have hit Rohingya camps in the past months. The cause of the blazes has remained unknown despite investigations. Rohingya are Muslims from Myanmar. More than a million of them are currently living in overcrowded camps in the Cox's Bazar region. Most of them went there in 2017 following a Myanmar army crackdown on the community. Thousands have been evacuated as the worst flood in decades pummeled most parts of Australia. Authorities say that 10 million people have been affected since the floods began at the weekend. They say the New South Wales state is the worst hit, with about 18,000 moved to safety there. Another 15,000 are expected to be evacuated as well. No casualties have so far been reported. The downpour has washed away bridges and submerged houses. Authorities say that the rain will start easing from late Wednesday. However, they say that residents should not return to their homes immediately, as the flood threat remains likely. The death toll from Sunday's gun attacks in Niger's Tahoua region has risen to 137. Security officials say the deaths occurred when armed men on motorbikes raided three villages near the border with Mali and Burkina Faso. The government spokesman said that armed bandits now systematically target civilians and slam the bloodshed as brutal and horrific. No group has yet claimed responsibility, but officials have blamed the attacks on Daesh terrorists and their affiliates. Violence has surged in the Niger border areas in recent weeks. On March 15th, 66 people were killed in a similar raid in the Tillaberi region. And that is it for World News. It's goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Around. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به وقت حالا.
In the path of the Imam.
As a reminder, we said that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, highly respected the source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Hussein Burujerdi. Although the Imam himself was an outstanding figure among the religious scholars or ulama of seminaries, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, played an important role in bringing Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi from Burujer to Qom and strengthening his status as the greatest source of emulation of his era. Today, we are going to talk about Imam Khomeini's political approach during the era of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. Stay with us. Shia Muslims believe that government is only the right of the infallible imams, peace be upon them, or person who enjoys the most resemblance to the infallible imam. Some Shia religious scholars or ulama maintain that if it is impossible to establish an Islamic government, the Islamic community should cooperate with just rulers in a bid to prevent the shedding of innocent blood and setting the ground for implementation of justice in society. However, there are other religious scholars or ulama who reject direct cooperation with rulers and believe that Shia ulama must always keep an eye on the performance of rulers in order not to be tainted with politics. Hence, there are various approaches among religious scholars or ulama with respect to the relation of religion and politics. Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi rejected direct cooperation with the ruling system and stressed that ulama should supervise the activities of the rulers. But Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, not only rejected any cooperation with the ruling system, but also deemed the system as illegitimate and deemed it necessary to set up an Islamic system of government known as Velayat-e-Faqih, or rule of the supreme jurisprudent. Imam Khomeini, even before the arrival of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi in Qom, had written the book Kashful Asrar, in defense of over a millennium of struggles of Shia religious scholars or ulama in the field of safeguarding genuine Islam and deterring deviationist currents. He proved his high capacity in scrutinizing and analyzing various political currents and proving the pristine Islamic teachings. Imam Khomeini stepped up his political struggles after the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi. These struggles shaped nationwide demonstrations and finally led to the overthrow of the corrupt and despotic Pahlavi regime. During the leadership of Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi, Imam Khomeini refrained from causing rifts in the ranks of ulama and Muslims and tried his best to keep the respect and status of Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi. Thus, he would just give the Grand Ayatollah political consultation if there was a need to do so. Ayatollah Sobhani recounts the anecdote. He says, "During the era of Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi, we witnessed a glorious silence from Imam Khomeini. From the arrival of Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi in Qom till his passing away, the Imam only engaged in teaching, writing books, and training students. What caused the Imam's roaring cries to subside after the arrival of Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi in Qom? The point is that the Imam was the man of God. His move and silence was based on the axis of duty." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, attach very high importance to the position of source of emulation, especially the top one, who was at the helm of the seminaries. The most important thing for Imam Khomeini was unity and solidarity of different Islamic currents and sects. Once, one of the ulama or religious scholars in Qom had been beaten by the police in the city. Imam Khomeini was informed of this event, but he didn't make any decision, saying that it is the responsibility of the source of emulation and the head of the seminaries. He recommended the students to refer to Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi and didn't interfere in his responsibilities. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Yazdi recalls that in 1955, the famous preacher Mr. Falsafi started his struggles against Baha'ism in support of Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi, whilst the Pahlavi regime pretended to back the move. But we were faced with the Shah's 180-degree U-turn. He humiliated the source of emulation and the great religious scholars or ulama of Tehran. The Imam told me and a few people who had gone to him to know our duty on the event. If Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi permits, I will arouse the whole of Iran in one day against the Shah. In reaction to some of the friends to enter the scene of parliamentary election through nomination of some pious candidates, Imam Khomeini didn't accept the proposal for the respect of Grand Ayatollah Bolujadi and said that he would continue teaching and his other activities in seminary. Ayatollah Sobhani recalls that, he says, "I remember in 1951, when the parliamentary election was heated and the constituencies had been divided between the advocates of Mossadegh and the Shah, while none of the candidates was accepted by the ulama. One of the friends, by the name of Sheikh Asadullah Nurullahi, asked the Imam to enter the scene and introduce pious and committed candidates, or at least introduce one candidate for the city of Qom. But he apologized and reminded, he said, 'My duty is just teaching.'"
Debate.
Foreign ministers of Russia and China have met, a meeting amidst the U.S. onslaught of threats and sanctions against both countries. Why has the U.S. taken such hostile and aggressive approach against Russia and China? Meanwhile, both Russia and China have taken a more logical approach on world affairs, like how all countries should abide by the purposes and principles of the Charter of the United Nations, unlike the U.S. approach. In this edition of the debate, we will look at how the U.S. goal of decreasing China and Russian power may backfire due to its hostile approach towards the two nations.
China stresses the need for further cooperation with Russia amid rising tensions with the United States. Highlighting their long history of collaboration, Beijing has pledged to advance its strategic partnership with its ally to a higher level. This came after a meeting between the two countries' foreign ministers in the Chinese capital.
Lavrov's visit to China will further consolidate the good momentum of high-level development of China-Russia relations and keep closer strategic coordination in international affairs. China stands ready to work together with Russia to promote the development of the China-Russia Comprehensive Strategic Partnership of Coordination for a new era in a wider scope and broader areas and at a deeper level.
In similar remarks, Russia's top diplomat said Sino-Russian relations are at their best level in history. In an interview with Chinese media, Sergei Lavrov hailed the Treaty of Good Neighborliness and Friendly Cooperation signed less than 20 years ago between the two sides. He said Beijing and Moscow are working to develop shared international policies and build on the historic pact.
We are promoting a constructive, unifying agenda together with China, hoping to ensure that the international structure is based on extensive cooperation and integrated cooperation between countries to achieve fairness, democracy, and stability. For example, we and our Chinese friends are developing integration processes in the Eurasian region.
Lavrov also accused the U.S. and its allies of trying to obstruct the rise of new financial and political powers. He said the West is opposed to a more multipolar world and suggested that China and Russia should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their economies against Western sanctions.
Everyone knows that the U.S. claims to restrict sci-tech development in Russia and China as a target. Therefore, we should promote the settlement of local currencies and other international currencies that can replace the U.S. dollar by enhancing independent innovation, to gradually get rid of the international payment systems controlled by the West and reduce the risk of sanctions. The sanction policies by the West go against the right trend of history, yet the course of history cannot be stopped.
In recent years, China and Russia have gotten increasingly closer to one another. The two sides have often voted in the same line at the United Nations Security Council on issues ranging from the crisis in Venezuela and the conflict in Syria to the Iran nuclear deal. And now, as U.S. President Joe Biden calls his Russian counterpart a killer and persists in a tough economic and political stance against China, the alliance between Beijing and Moscow sounds all the more essential to counter Washington's unilateralism.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate from the Executive Intelligence Review, Bill Jones, joins us from Leesburg. And International Relations and Security Analyst Mark Sloboda joins us from Moscow. I'd like to welcome both of you. Mark Sloboda, let me first start with you. Before departing for China, the foreign minister of Russia told reporters that Moscow and Beijing should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their economies against Western sanctions. And he accused the West of trying to maintain its domination over the global economy and international politics at any cost, including through sanctions. We've heard this about the dollar quite often from Russia, from China, from Iran. Do you think that's something that is feasible, that it actually can be done, or will it be just limited to both countries in terms of how they do their trade in their own national currencies?
Hi, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the debate. Definitely. China and Russia both began a serious policy of de-dollarization in 2017. And Russia has, by the end of last year, reduced its foreign currency holdings. Russia has quite significant reserves to just 19%. It has a higher percentage of gold now, for instance, than dollars. China has done as well. They've reduced their U.S. foreign currency holdings from $1.8 trillion in 2017 to now just over $1 trillion. That's almost a half cut. That is a 50%. That's pretty significant by both countries in reducing. Plus, their trade with each other is now less than 50% conducted with the dollar. And they've both started to use this policy in their trade with other countries. Russia and the EU, for instance, have increased their trade with each other's currencies, getting out of the realm of the dollar. So the U.S.'s constant economic warfare on the other countries of the world through the use of sanctions, tariffs, and the like, the threat of being cut off from U.S.-controlled international financial transit systems has reached such a level that it's backfired. And now when even the EU is considering forming alternatives to SWIFT, the financial, the U.S.-controlled international financial payment system, you know that even when U.S. allies are being threatened by U.S. sanctions, like Germany over Nord Stream 2 or Turkey over its purchase of the S-400, that the reign of the dollar as the sole international reserve currency for the world is coming to an end rather quickly.
Very well. It's interesting about what you said about the EU. I didn't know that. I have to look into that. Well, let's see here, Bill Jones. I'm going to highlight some of the points made by the Chinese publication about the meeting that took place between the foreign ministers, even though that's somewhat unjournalistic. Pretty much all said that the United States should reflect on the damage it has done to global peace and development in recent years. Some said to stop unilateral bullying, the U.S. should stop that. It should stop interfering in other countries' internal affairs and to stop pulling small circles to engage in group confrontation. I'm not too sure what that means. Now, that's the Chinese version. Does that match reality?
Absolutely, 100%. What the U.S. is doing now, what the Biden administration is doing, is taking the worst parts of the Trump administration and making it into their own policy. And that is, they're not only moving against China, but also moving against Russia in an attempt to maintain U.S. hegemony in the world. This is at a point in time where China has become probably the most important economic producer. If the world comes out of this economic crisis, it'll largely be due to the fact that China's economy has come in gear very early in this COVID crisis. And secondly, that the rest of the world is not quite so willing to follow the United States as it would have been 20, 30 years ago. President Biden has not quite understood this, and he thinks he's going to bring a cordon of containment around China and Russia. The meeting, the attack on President Putin was just absolutely unheard of, but also the meeting in Anchorage. This was the most undiplomatic treatment given by the United States. And as far as I know, in 20 years at the White House, I have never seen anything so insulting as the way that they greeted, so-called, the Chinese representatives. And that, therefore, you had a lot of fireworks after that. The Chinese were prepared for that to some extent. I think that's why they have arranged this meeting between the foreign ministers shortly after the Anchorage meeting, even before they knew what was going to happen at Anchorage, because they knew there was going to be trouble. They have a combined interest here. They're both under attack. They're both major countries in the world. This is a world now which can no longer be controlled by a single so-called superpower. We don't have a superpower anymore economically, and really not even militarily. And but that the message has not gotten home to the White House yet. But I think what China and Russia are doing now is preparing just an alternative to what the U.S. is trying to impose on the world. Just one thing on the financial situation, it's not so much the role of the dollar. The dollar-based system, which I call the London-New York-controlled financial system, is really bankrupt. There's more debt than can ever be paid. And there has to be a fundamental financial reform of the international system if the world's going to move forward. And therefore, the dollar, so-called dollar-denominated system is really should be put on the ash can of history, and we should get a system which benefits all peoples.
Right. Well, I don't, Mark Sloboda, I don't want to make this a U.S. bashing debate, but what Bill Jones there said is very interesting, because you look at the way that, for example, that meeting took place in Alaska, and the way that the U.S. railed against China, You take a look at comments made by the U.S. President recently against Putin, calling him a killer. The path that the U.S. President Biden boasted about was a diplomatic one. He said it's going to be about diplomacy. But yet we have seen Russia, after being the president, after being called a killer, say, listen, let's have a meeting online. The U.S. rejected it. You have now China, who has been also subjected to U.S. sanctions, also carried a diplomatic approach, even though it's been stoked and provoked by the U.S. In a variety of fronts. So my question is, Russia and China seem to be taking that route that the U.S. is preaching, where it's not.
Yeah, so when Biden came into the White House, the idea of a Biden-Blinken era was promoted with the slogan, diplomacy is back. And we must have an entirely different definition of the word diplomacy. I think we need to change the names of the U.S. departments to the U.S. Department of Sanctions and the U.S. Department of War, because that you get one or the other. That seems to be the only treatment. The U.S. has escalated tensions with Russia already. They have escalated tensions with China, not just verbally, diplomatically at meetings, but they have, the Biden administration has increased already military provocations in the Black Sea against Russia, in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Straits. They've already sent two aircraft carriers through there, and on another passage by another a U.S. naval vessel, and Biden has only been in office since the middle of January. This is really escalating the tensions with what the U.S. sees as its peer or near-peer competitors. And on top of that, the U.S. is, the Biden administration, contrary to belief, seems to be walking away from the idea of restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran by demanding that Iran return to full compliance first, when it was the U.S. that initially unilaterally walked out of the treaty. That seems some kind of absolute hubris and exceptionalism. And considering Iranian elections will be hotly contested coming up in June, they seem to be just, throwing any possibility of the JCPOA being restored out the window, which I think is shocking a lot of people. Also, with North Korea, they are escalating tensions there, insisting on changing the terminology from denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula to denuclearization of North Korea, meaning they have no intent of taking their own nuclear-capable bombers and other military gear out of the peninsula. And even South Korea has objected to this. South Korea has been improving relations with North Korea, and they don't want this overbearing change in tact coming from the United States. So South Korea is starting to question their position as a client state. Mm-hmm. And then we see the Biden conducting military strikes, killing Iraqis in Syria, the sovereign country, supposedly to send a message to Iran. This none of this has anything to do with diplomacy. This is warmongering. This is hegemony trying to feel its strength again, and it's simply not going to work.
Okay, expand on that more with you, Bill Jones. The way it's treating Russia, the U.S., the way it's treating China, the way it's treating Iran, Venezuela, Syria, in some respects, Iraq. The list is rather long in terms of how the U.S. just wants to take control. It wants to use the military approach. It flies B-52. Interestingly, it flew a B-52 bomber, I believe, recently, where it had Israel also escorted with fighter jets. Is it all about the U.S. Outdated in its approach, and that U.S. and China, not to say that they should lead the way, but after all, they are the two powerful countries that can do that. And again, not to say that there should be a sole superpower, because those days are over, correct? Is that what's happening?
That's correct. There is a lot of the old thinking. Let me address the question that you would ask otherwise with regard to the Chinese and Russian diplomatic reaction to the insults coming from the U.S. I think it's very smart I think they know that that this is the behavior of the U.S. has been off the wall, but they're trying to give an olive branch, give a way out to continued confrontation. And I think that's very smart because who was it says, I think Churchill said at one time, the Americans will always do the right thing after they've tried every other option. That the Biden administration is working on the basis of an illusion that there is a, that they are a remaining superpower, that they can rebuild this alliance that they thought they had 20 years ago. And I think it's going to fail. I think the Quad is not going to be what they think it's going to be. As the other speaker mentioned, both South Korea, whom they tried to pressure into the Quad, are not going to have any part of it. India also is not a, such a solid member of the Quad as one may think. And I think even the Japanese, although they're trying to talk tough and be the good partner of the United States, given all their economic ties with China and the option of China as really the, their future in terms of a market for their products, I think there may be rethinking there as well. And in, here in the United States, of course, people have reacted to a large extent to much of what the Biden administration's been doing, attacking China. The attacks on Asian Americans, I think, are a result of the very hysterical response to China, both by the Trump administration and by the Biden administration. So Biden may play it differently, but I think that is the case. And unless they can adopt an attitude of coming to terms with these two major powers, and I think short of going to war, I think the only option is that they do find a new paradigm of working. But I think it will only happen at the point that they see that what they're doing now is a failure.
Well, Mark Sloboda, some people or viewers who may be watching this are going to say, well, what is this about the U.S., the unraveling of the U.S.? This is not going to happen. And they have, you know, they're in that camp. Obviously, still going with the thinking that the U.S. is the sole superpower, the U.S. leads, should police the world, et cetera. Now, at the same time, however, the question should come about, given the fact that both you and you know, Bill Jones agree on this fact that the U.S. is unraveling to some degree, how will it take the U.S. to actually, for that to happen? I mean, there's institutions like, I'm looking at the Five Eyes, for example, the intelligence sharing that happens between these countries, just one of many institutions that the U.S. is part of that it leads the way, along with others that you could probably cite. I mean, is this really a realistic thing to say about the U.S.?
Yeah, I think you need to have a little bit of moderation in what we're talking about with the U.S. failing. You know, the U.S. is still the most powerful country in the world militarily. It will be for at least another decade or two. They are still, if not the number one economic power in the world, depending on, you know, your value of your assessment, they're at least the number two. And the U.S. will be I believe they're still a superpower, actually, but they're on a trend going down. They still will be the first among equals for some decades to come. There's no question of that. The idea is that the U.S. will no longer be able to exert its hegemony in other areas of the world, such as the immediate Russian sphere, the Pacific sphere around China, the way they've become accustomed to in the era of the hyperpower since the 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed. The U.S. starts from a very high point, so this fall will be gradual. It must be said, particularly when we're talking economically, U.S., Russia and China don't want the U.S. to fall economically dramatically because that would take the rest of the world down with it. They want to divest themselves relatively gradually. They want this to be a controlled process. They don't want the U.S., at least economically, to fail overnight because of the potential consequences for the rest of the world. I mean, U.S. and China's economies in particular, Russia's less so, are still, you know, locked together in a frenemy-type relationship, no matter how much the U.S. Under Trump began a process of economic decoupling. So this will take a while. It's about denying the ability of the U.S. military and you could also say the U.S. economically to exert its control over every corner of the world at will. And the U.S. talks about this particularly in the idea of air defense as area access and area denial. And they are being denied the ability to exert their will by air power, by economic power in primary areas of the world. Hegemony is over in that extent, but its recession will be gradual unless there is a major confrontation such as a U.S. Conflict with China off China's coast in the South China Sea. And unfortunately, there's a lot of U.S. military brass and geopolitical thinkers that have locked themselves into this Thucydides trap thinking of the falling and hegemon being met by what they believe must be a rising hegemon, China. They believe conflict there is inevitable. And if they lock themselves into that, such a military clash, such of that, could then accelerate U.S. hegemonic power and the decline of U.S. hegemonic power to a more abrupt acceleration.
Now, unfortunately, we're out of time. I wish we could just continue this discussion. We just don't have the time. Let me thank our guests from the Executive Intelligence Review, Bill Jones. Thank you very much for your comments there from Leesburg. Also, international relations and security analyst that was talking there, Mark Sloboda. Thank you so much. Spoke to us from Moscow. That does it for this edition of The Debate. Let me go with that. My entire team here in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام يوم المظلوم على الظالم أشد من يوم الظالم على المظلوم
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "The day of the oppressed over the oppressor will be severer than the day of the oppressor over the oppressed."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great lessons which we learn, dear friends, from the truly universal persona of Imam Ali is this concept of bravery, courage, and valor. Truly, in today's age, we find that bravery, courage, valor, manliness, if you will, is something that is rarely seen on the global level. For some reason, especially when we look towards the leaders of certain countries across the world, we find that they are rude, arrogant, mean, lowly, and cowards. How we wish we would live in an age where the leaders of countries were brave and valorous. They were honorable and noble. We find that Imam Ali alayhi salam in his time was the most valorous man. But not only was he brave and courageous, he was also humble and pious. The valorous men of the time too have learned the lessons